What Habermas calls civil society develops, he says, as the corollary of a depersonalized state authority. The first point he made then is a historical one about the forms of power across the period that he's describing from about 1700, say, to our own time. If you look at two representations here, here's from the 1965 RSC production of Hamlet. Key point to make is if we have Claudius, the usurper king, in the centre, and Hamlet, as is traditional these days, in black on the margins, either left or right. But if we notice the centre of the stage flooded with light, the king at the centre, if you think of Louis XIV's famous proclamation that I am the state. This particular sense in which for the earlier period, statehood is concentrated in the person of the king, the emperor, the queen, etc. We see that registered in the 65 production, but also in last year's Old Globe Theatre in San Diego in the US production. Again, the same thing with kings and royals at the centre of power. The openness of the medieval and early modern state. So that the king would often hold meetings of state in his bedroom, for instance, particularly in the French cases, where sort of the state inseparable from the person of the king. So when Habermas speaks of the emergence of a depersonalized state authority, what he's describing is that power moves from power exercised in this way in the earlier period, and for us exercised in a quite different way. Here, a decision making. But through an anonymous, depersonalized election. So today we live in a world in which civil society, go back to this representation, there is no concept of civil society at this time. There is, of course, the state, the court. But outside of that, there is the public, if you like. But civil society as a group of people who come together in some sense or who exist in some way with legislative or authoritative functions doesn't yet exist. When Kant writes his essay in the Berliner Monatsschrift, which we looked at last week, he is appealing to a civil society, one which doesn't yet quite exist, but which might be taken to exist. When novelists are writing, are they directing their words at a civil society, rather than in this concept of the court, as distinct from the great unwashed, the masses on the other side? An intermediate stratum begins to develop, and this is what Habermas is particularly focused on. So in the 17th and the 18th centuries, he suggests, civil society sets itself up in opposition, or at least in contradistinction to the state. But it doesn't involve society at large, but only a minority group. I say in opposition or in contradistinction, it's not necessary that the form of civil society is in opposition to the state. When those groups of conversing people meet, they're not necessarily anti-statists. They can, on the contrary, be supporting the state. But they emerge as a body which might in principle think in opposition to the state, and at least exist separately from the court or from the state. And so Habermas then speaks of this public, this new form, the civil society, which emerges as the abstract counterpart, he says, of the new form of the state. So we might guess that the new public is made up, at least partly, if we're thinking of how it comes about, of the old burghers, the privileged citizenry of the new towns in medieval and early modern Europe. But according to Habermas, this isn't the case. The group that he's talking about, this new stratum of what he calls bourgeois people, he says that these capitalists, the merchants, bankers, entrepreneurs, manufacturers, belong to that group of the bourgeois who, like the new category of scholars, I think of Kant in that case, were not really burghers in the traditional sense, in the sense in which we encountered burghers, the heads of cities, for instance, in the medieval city state, or Genoa, Venice, etc. The stratum of bourgeois was the real carrier of the public, he says, which from the outset was a reading public. So reading public being very important, because in fact much of what is being discussed here is not discussed necessarily face to face, but sometimes through the medium of print. This is also the period in which newspapers begin to develop, and newspapers and opinion go side by side, and it's that Habermas is particularly interested in. Last week we looked at Kant's essay, and we discovered that articles like his, which involved matters of public reason, were addressed to a wide lay public, in principle addressed to anybody who could read. Those had become fairly widespread in Europe by the mid-18th century, even earlier in England. In Prussia, of course, where Kant was, as elsewhere, where an absolutist monarch or an emperor ruled, publications of that kind were feared, and every attempt was made to neutralize or to domesticate them. Here's the point that Habermas makes. Even the use of one's reason as such was subject to regulation. All chaired professors, turns out that the day was Thursday, I think I'd said Monday or Friday, but it's Thursday. And this is a rescript to Frederick II from 1784. Notice that date. That, of course, is the date in which Kant also published his essay. A private person has no right to pass public and perhaps even disapproving judgment on the actions, procedures, laws, etc. And for a private person, is not at all capable of making such judgment because he lacks complete knowledge of circumstances and motives. Here's the emperor and the despot arguing against the use of private reason in public. So that in the sense in which where Kant and Mendelssohn and others were writing in the papers and saying, discussing, for instance, whether it was possible, whether it would be a good idea to have marriages outside of the state. Here's the emperor saying that you don't have the jurisdiction to do that, claiming, of course, that you don't have the knowledge of it, but in fact making a law saying that you could be imprisoned if you do. Very clearly, no sooner had this organ of opinion emerged than it was opposed. So it had to emerge against a genuine opposition on the part of the state. Consider, I think we've mentioned this in some of the seminars last week. One other point. In England, just to mention, the first coffee house, the coffee house being one of these places in which private individuals, private persons of opinion, often would come together to meet. That was the coffee house. Coffee had begun to be imported, coffee and tea, for that matter, imported from the East, and began to be a popular taste in the 17th century. So sugar, of course, was also being imported then. And people would go to coffee houses for their, quite often, twice a day, very often, and you would sit there for an hour or so, and of course you would get into conversation, and that conversation would very often be on public matters. Coffee houses, which began in the 17th century in England, the first coffee house opened in Oxford in 1650. First London coffee house opened in 1652. But what's interesting is that by 1675, in other words, only 25 years later, Charles II closed all the coffee houses in the realm. He declared them seminaries of sedition. So precisely the sense that Charles II didn't have the authority to publish a document like this. He wasn't an absolutist ruler. But he said that coffee houses were seminaries of sedition. Anti-statist activities were taking place in them, and he closed them all. But it created such an outrage that he was obliged a year later to rescind the order. People were so was so committed to this new institution. Consider the example of Thomas Paine's Rights of Man. Paine was a very strong supporter of the French Revolution that began in 1789. He visited France in 1790. Many English thinkers and writers supported the revolution, including Richard Price, who initiated what was called the Revolution Controversy. It was a matter of fierce discussion among the English chattering classes, if you like, in the 1790s through the 1800s. If you think of, say, the title of Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility, you see the French Revolution playing itself out through these titles. That novel written in what in the first decade of the new century, the 19th, so 1810, something like that. Price wrote a sermon and a pamphlet which applauded the events of 1789. Conservative intellectuals responded the other way. Edmund Burke famously wrote a counter-revolutionary attack which he called Reflections on the Revolution in France, which if you're a romanticist and so on, is still very much read. That strongly appealed to the landed class, and it sold 30,000 copies, which was a lot. Burke argued for the legitimacy of the aristocratic government, and Paine responded to Burke in turn. Paine's Rights of Man, subtitled Answer to Mr. Burke's Attack, was published in the year after Burke's. Here's Paine's essay. It was a 90,000 word book. It sold around 1 million copies, which is extraordinary. As I said already, that Burke published his book, it sold 30,000. Paine sells 1 million, in other words, more than 10 times the number, more than 30 times the number. It was extraordinarily widely read. By reformers, by Protestant dissenters, by Democrats, by London craftsmen and the skilled factory hands of the new industrial north. So that we have to imagine that this book being read, and because in fact large numbers of people were not yet literate, read aloud also. You would read it to groups of people in coffee houses, there would be readings of Paine's book, with fierce conversation afterwards, debate, etc., etc. Of the 300 or more pamphlets which were the revolution controversy spawned, Rights of Man was the first which seriously damaged Burke's case and restored credit to the French Revolution, both in Britain and in the US. The publication caused a furore in England. Paine was tried in absentia, convicted of seditious libel against the crown, but he couldn't be hanged since he had fled to France, and he never returned to England. He wasn't the only advocate of the Rights of Man, or the only author of a work called Rights of Man, of course. The working class radical Thomas Spence, those of you from Newcastle might know him. Here's the plaque, I'm still there, born in Quayside, utopian writer, land reformer, courageous pioneering campaigner for the rights of women and men, etc. He had written a book already in 1790. And Thomas Paine's acquaintance, Mary Wollstonecraft, who again you probably know, he met her via their common publisher. She wrote A Vindication of the Rights of Man before she wrote A Vindication of the Rights of Woman. That Vindication of the Rights of Man, her text, was one of the very first works to attack Burke. She extended those arguments later, of course, in the 1792 Vindication of the Rights of Women. So when it comes to talking about the blueprint of the public sphere, here's what Habermas writes. So it's a sphere of private people come together as a public. That's a key element. They are private people coming together as a public. They are not people who are not people meeting, let's say, in the Inns of Court. They're not people meeting in Westminster on government business. They're not there in their representative capacity. They're there as private people, you and me, in a certain sense. We go to an anonymous public space where we form a public. Private and public come together, and the two are crucially necessary. You can see that this is, as it were, in contradistinction to politics, the world of the state, the world of the courts. These are not just lawyers talking among themselves. They're not just the politicians talking among themselves. They're not just teachers talking among themselves or religious people. They are private people from all walks of life coming together to form a public. And they soon claimed the public sphere. I'll say more about this a little later, but think of the public sphere both as a place, but also as a kind of venue. Habermas's word, Öffentlichkeit, openness or publicness. So what they're claiming is publicness. They're claiming, in fact, that this space that they constitute, that they have invented, is a crucial space, and they claim it against the public authorities. They engage in a debate over the general rules governing relations in the basically privatized but publicly relevant sphere of commodity exchange and social labor. So there they are in the coffee houses. The coffee houses along the Strand, along Fleet Street in London, for the very good reason that this is near Customs House. It's near the places in which people would take papers. Tradesmen would take papers. News would come in of shipments from the East or from the West Indies. It would be checked in at the Customs House, and the people who had brought that news would go for their coffee. Inside there, of course, were journalists, were people who, tradesmen, who stand, if you could get it, if you knew, for instance, that, £50 of sugar was going to be available that day, it would give them an advantage in the commodities market. So you had an interest in going sometimes to these coffee houses where you would hear this news. So basically privatized, but publicly relevant sphere of commodity exchange. The medium of this political confrontation, he says, it was people's public use of their reason. So we'll go on from that. Here just the word that I had mentioned about Öffentlichkeit from Thomas Burger's note. The very title may be variously rendered as public, the public, public sphere, although, as I said, I think last week, public sphere rather creates the impression it's only a place. It isn't only the place, it's the exercise of openness in some ways that Habermas is trying to get at. Publicity itself, although for us, of course, publicity tends to shade, doesn't it, into advertising. This is not separate from advertising, but it's not just advertising. And then also this other term, bürgerlich, which obviously burger, bourgeois, citizen, but those two categories of the bourgeois and the citizen come together. Both, of course, are very historically resonant terms. when does citizen or citoyen begin to be developed? Well, it's in the French Revolution, this idea of one's citizenship, of one's rights as a French citizen. That precisely means, in fact, that you have rights because you are French. You constitute a public again. It is a crucial development. Have a look at the at some things about the English coffee houses, the first ones to develop. Habermas does a great deal of comparative work in the book, and he focuses mostly on three sets of institutions: the English coffee houses, and then the German and the French equivalents. The French equivalent is not quite the same; it's the salons. And the salons, are slightly more upmarket than the coffee houses. They're a place in which in certain kinds of verbal competitions or verbal jousting take place. They're less rambunctious often, they're more acidic, they're more lettered in some way. In Germany, the institutions are called Tischgesellschaften, table societies. So sometimes around the consumption of tea or coffee, but sometimes merely in public, in open spaces, for instance, in the great kind of beer taverns of places like Munich or Berlin, where people would gather and discussions would take place. There are three sets of institutions, and they have slightly different laws, which are quite significant to think through. Some of them expressly ban women from appearing, and that obviously has implications for the kinds of claims you can make. What kind of an institution is the public sphere? But others don't. So here we get this these statements. They act as alternative sphere for intellectual thought. Political groups frequently use them as meeting places. Relative equality existed among patrons of coffee houses despite station. One could participate in conversation regardless of class, rank, or political leaning. In some respects, they were socially similar to alehouses or inn. This idea of the relative the relative equality existed is crucial to the argument that Habermas is going to make. You could, of course, be Prince Harry, as it were, who drops into to a coffee house. But you could also be me, who drops into one. And inside that space, it's almost as though for Habermas, what happens as you enter the door, you have to pay for your coffee. So they're governed by commodity exchange, by access to a certain small amount of money. They weren't very expensive. But you could sit there, you could listen to the discussions, or you could participate. And it did, you know, when you participated, it didn't matter. You didn't stand up and say, "I am Prince Harry, this is what I think, and therefore my authority derives from the fact that that's who I am." Your authority in the space would derive from your rhetorical skill, from the quality of your argument, very often. If you made the argument in an impassioned way and persuaded people, you carried the day, whether or not you were highborn or not. This is of fundamental importance to Habermas. So that no man of any station need give his place to a finer man. Extraordinary in its rupture. In would come some royals, you were sitting down, you didn't need to cede your place. You didn't need to say, "Oh, I'm sorry, you know, you should sit here." You had paid your money, you had your coffee before you, you had a right to be there and to speak. You didn't have to shorten what you were going to say because they wanted to speak also, etc. If a quarrel broke out, the instigator was required to purchase the offended party a cup of coffee. The topic of sacred things was barred. So religion was too controversial, it seems, and so on. Rules existed against speaking poorly of the state as well as of the scriptures. The rules forbade game of chance such as cards and dice as well. If you look at visual representations, here's one, Ned Ward's wealthy shopkeeper, gives a sense of the use of the coffee house. So he is he's a writer. He writes in the Spectator, I think. Rise at 5, counting house till 8, then breakfast on toast and Cheshire cheese. in his shop for 2 hours, then a neighboring coffee house for news. For news, in other words, he goes there to read the newspaper, but also to hear what people have to say. Shop again till dinner, 1 o'clock, then Lloyd's Coffee House for business, shop again, another coffee house, not Lloyd's, for recreation. 3 coffee houses in the day, gathering news, hearing stuff, and so on. Businessmen often kept regular hours at a particular house where clients would know how to find them. This is just one famous representation, the Coffee House Mob, 1710. And you see the people arranged discussions breaking out and so on. Here, Jonathan's Coffee House in London. Notice that it's not just one conversation that's taking place, but several. It wasn't, as it were, an organized, you didn't sort of put a notice up saying, today we will discuss the following. It would just happen, and it would happen among people who happened to be sitting next to each other because they were among tables, etc. You didn't initially know your neighbor, but you would just get into a discussion. One final, this is a slightly more high-toned place. Again, notice the people reading the newspaper, but the conversation about the news that is breaking out. Notice again the absence of women from the gathering. So we'll come back to this question of the absence of women later on. So all of these institutions, the Tischgesellschaften, the salons, and the coffee houses, Habermas said, had 3 things in common. And it's crucial to think about these when we're trying to evaluate the claims that he's making about the public sphere. Firstly, they preserved a kind of social intercourse that, far from presupposing the equality of status, disregarded status altogether. That's the first thing. In other words, they presupposed that private people come together to form a public, had their own views, and that each person's view was in principle as good or as bad as the next person's view. Status was disregarded. It was, as I said, as though you checked your status at the door with your coat. You came in the door, you took off your crown, or you took off your pauper's rags, and you went and sat down. Status was disregarded altogether. Think about the historical unprecedentedness of this kind of venue. People coming together precisely to engage in social intercourse, who don't have the same class experience, the same ethnic background, everything is different about the people that are there. If you think of developments much, much later that bring together members of the classes, and think of how carefully they work to preserve separation. I'm thinking, for instance, of Olmsted's the architect who designs Central Park in New York. Central Park, of course, is between East Side and West Side, designed to bring people together, the walkways and so on and so forth. But and specifically with the various rises and falls, places where you can be private, places where you can be more public. So that what he imagines already is that nannies, for instance, carrying children, are going to be in the park at the same time as the high and mighty are going to be in the park. But the park is not designed for bringing them together except spatially, or except physico-spatially. They're not meant to talk to one another. And in fact, all the evidence is that people never really got into masses of people talking together in Central Park, which is much later. It's 1860 we're talking about. This is 1760. And here, specifically, it's a kind of talking in which status ceases to be significant that matters. So, second point. Discussion within such a space presupposes the problematization of areas that until then had not been questioned. The very fact that you've got these private citizens come together as a public means that what they're going to talk about, they're going to raise issues that hadn't hitherto been given a voice. Church and state continue to exercise a monopoly of interpretation over the domain of common concern, even when they were banned, as in the examples we gave. But precisely to the degree that philosophical and literary works of art in general were produced for the market and distributed through it, they followed the route of information and became commodities, thereby becoming in principle generally accessible. One of the things that, one of the sets of things that was most often discussed in the public houses was the latest production of X, Y, and Z, the latest novel that was had been written. Have you read Fielding's X? And then there would be discussion about, was it a good book, was it a bad book? Precisely because literature was available as a commodity, it wasn't written any longer under circumstances of patronage. It wouldn't be given, it wouldn't be made necessary. You wouldn't make a poem for a baronet or a work of art for somebody specifically. It would be a commodity object on the market. It would sell. This is the beginning of the idea of the novel specifically as a form that is a commodity object being much discussed. Plays and so on were often discussed as well. Works of music, well-known works of music, Handel, for instance, was widely consumed and discussed at this time in England. So this third point is the same process that converts culture into a commodity established the public as in principle inclusive. The issues discussed became general, not merely in their significance, but also in their accessibility. Everyone had to be able to participate. Not everybody did participate, of course. But in principle, think about the novel, you couldn't participate if you were not literate. But if you were literate, and if you had the penny, or whatever it cost to buy the work, you were in principle able to participate. The same thing in these discussions. You would have something to say in the coffee house if you thought about the issues. In principle, anybody could participate. This is the sense in which you can see in some way here, the logic, we'll go much more into this the rest of this term, but the logic of the marketplace beginning to play itself out here. In the marketplace, of course, what renders you able or unable to participate is how much money you have. But if you have the money, you can buy it. It doesn't matter if you're a prince or a pauper. So there's a sense in which the commodity merely offers itself to sale for sale to the people who can afford it. It doesn't ask after status. And there's a suggestion here that information and ideas are beginning to follow the same route. Which is quite interesting. We can speak, in other words, of this as, in some sense, as following the route of the capitalization of production generally. So the same thing is happening in the world of ideas. So Habermas's argument is that what is historically new about the challenge posed by the public sphere is that it offered, as he puts it, to change domination as such. What it proposed entailed not just an exchange of the basis of legitimation while domination was maintained in principle. Of course, it happened many times before that a new ruler would come about or somebody would be overthrown. The basis of domination would be changed. Here the suggestion is that domination as such was being challenged. Hence Habermas's argument to change domination as such. What is authority in the world of the public sphere? Think of that idea that right, not authority, makes the law or makes truth. In the public sphere, exactly the opposite. Authority, in other words, authority, not right. Here it's right. What's right makes truth. And what's right is a matter of argument. Is it this way or is it that way? Brexit or not Brexit? What is true? You know, the better argument, of course, that's not necessarily going to work out this way for various reasons, but the better argument has an opportunity to prevail. It's not because the state decrees that such and such a line ought to be followed. Perhaps Brexit is not the best example. So the second part of the text, that's the first main thing to get hold of, if you like. That what is being suggested here is that that truth, in some sense, is the result of public reason. Truth isn't given by God, it's not declared by the state. The public comes together and constitutes a version, its own version of truth at a particular moment. And that changes what domination means. It changes what power, how power is exercised. In other words, the people follow you not because you are the king, but because you might have you're good at putting things. You can reason stuff out. Where Kant speaks about an age of enlightenment, this is what he has in mind. Habermas's second place that Habermas goes to in this essay, and maybe I should say something about the book itself. It was published as Habermas's Habilitation Schrift in 1962. The Habilitation is in Germany. You have to write two PhDs to get a job. The one is to get your doctorate. The second one is to get a full-time position. And this was the second one that Habermas did to get his to get a full-time job in 1962. This, of course, was the moment of the uprising, the student movement in Germany. It became a very well-known text through the 60s and into the 70s. It became, in fact, tremendously significant, not only in the German-speaking world, but it was translated into countless other languages, and it became a widely discussed text. It was picked up by sociologists, by feminists, by people doing work on the rise of the novel, and so on and so forth. The one exception to all this was English. For some weird reason, it wasn't translated into English until the mid-1990s. Habermas himself went on to have a major career. He's probably the world's most important living sociologist and a very significant figure across the globe, including the Anglophone world. But it's odd that by the time this book of his was finally translated into English, we in English knew a lot of his other books, but not this early one. So it has a strange kind of a reputation. When it was published in English, it became a vast kind of bestseller in cultural studies, where people were really interested in what it had to say about the relationship between public discourse, the forms of writing, and specifically it was important for feminist debates about inclusion or exclusion in democratic forms. So it was people argued for or against. We'll talk more about that later. But one of the things that Habermas does is to ask himself the question of what form of subjectivity, what kind of person do you have to be to participate in the bourgeoisie, to go into one of those coffee houses and speak? And this is where the debate becomes tremendously interesting, it seems to me, because it turns out, of course, we can identify some of the obvious inclusions and exclusions. If you spoke fluently, in an unaccented way perhaps, if you're able to frame your views well, it stands to reason that you would be able to carry the day more often than people who couldn't do those things. So that you begin to see that a certain kind of educational, cultural capital underlies the carrying of the debates here. But also, for instance, the formal exclusion of women, for instance, from some of these venues meant that no matter how good you were at reasoning, if you're a woman, you could not participate in those spaces. But Habermas is saying, what equips you, as it were, what gives you the... he's thinking of such things as self-confidence. What equips you to go into a coffee house and to stand up and articulate your views? How do you become a kind of a participant rather than just a spectator or witness to those things? And he begins to think about the relationship between bourgeois publicness, and the space of the home. how is the family organized? So that the family equips you. I mean, in other words, what's the familial history of this gentleman here? What enables him to do this? And it's here, I think, that Habermas makes some tremendously interesting arguments. his writing isn't always doesn't always trip off the page, let's say. Sometimes it's ponderous, and the title of one of the subsections here is equally ponderous, but it's tremendously interesting, I think. The bourgeois family and the institutionalization of a privateness oriented towards an audience. So the bourgeois family and a privateness oriented towards an audience. A privateness means, in some sense, a privateness, think of private enterprise, as we understand that term. So these are people who are commodity merchants, quite often. They're selling stuff. They have their views. Their views are often shaped by what they do. They're merchants. They're Grub Street wits. They are certain kinds of painters and artists. They are private citizens, but with views. And they express those views. And Habermas is saying, how does the bourgeois family, specifically the bourgeois family, not the working class family, not the family that Hamlet grew up in, it's this middle stratum that he's interested in. The argument is that one enters the public sphere out of a private life that had assumed institutional form in the enclosed space of the patriarchal conjugal sphere, or the conjugal family. Habermas speaks of the intimate sphere here. The bourgeois family as an institution was, of course, as he says, dependent on the sphere of labor and commodity exchange. Let me just try and short-circuit what he's saying here. It's really important to read this again, if you like. There's one particular passage that I would like you to read before tomorrow. But think about two issues. Well, think, if you like, of the performative contradiction of the patriarchal bourgeois conjugal family, as Habermas describes it. On the one hand, the family socializes you, equips you to enter the marketplace, the world of competition, of cut and thrust. It gives you the skills, the bourgeois family, which is a relatively privileged, it gives you the skills to succeed. That is to say, it teaches you to be ruthless, competitive, nasty, and evil. It has to enable you to do those things. You're imbued with the ability to compete in this marketplace. Education is about not only about your succeeding, but about in some senses about succeeding where others don't succeed. At the same time, and it is at the same time, partners. It's hard to think these two together. The bourgeois family is also the scene or the site of the cultivation of self. At least that's one of the ideologies. I mean, if you think, obviously, of the great poem, that your parents are what fuck you up, is the way in which it works for them. But that, of course, is maybe the harsh world of reality. The bourgeois family, the ideology of it, is that it nurtures you. It allows you to be yourself. You grow up in the space of safety, a safe haven in a heartless world. And the bourgeois family protects you, nurtures you, cultivates you. You experience love there. So there are these two things that work together in the bourgeois family. And Habermas is saying, how do we think these two things together? As he puts it, the conjugal family's self-image of its intimate sphere collided even within the consciousness of the bourgeoisie itself with the real functions of the bourgeois family. So the family's self-image of its intimate sphere is that notion of protection, cultivation, looking up, that idea of intimacy, of love across the generations, of love for your siblings, of the nurturing of yourself. On the other hand, there is the real functions of the bourgeois family, which are to produce the bourgeoisie of the future. to produce tomorrow's captains of industry, etc. Here's an image, obviously, of the Obama family. And here you see the bourgeois family's self-image, if you like. Here we have the two parents, the children nestling in the warmth and love and the ability of the parents to protect their children. The children growing up, cultivated, loved, knowing that they are loved. At the same time, of course, this is a bourgeois woman. The ultimate, in other words, the sense in which these children are being equipped to succeed in the world as it is. That sense of the there is a performative contradiction at the heart of bourgeois society. You don't choose one or the other side of those two things. You don't say the ideology is true, that this is a lie. Because what Habermas is saying is, whether it's a lie or not, it is a lie in one sense, but it's not experienced as a lie. Subjectively, we don't experience it as a lie. We might, if our background is one of maladjustment, and that sense of if we have been fucked up by our parents, we don't necessarily experience that way. But the ideology of the bourgeois family operates in this way. So Habermas is saying that in other words, that this, as he puts it, this is ideology. And yet it's more than ideology. That's an extraordinary formulation, I think, that he gives us. There's a key passage here. It's on page 48 of the book, so I'd like you to read that section very closely for tomorrow, if you would. It begins, although the needs of the bourgeois family. So we'll talk about that in lectures. It's tremendously important to tease these things out. So his conclusion is that the fully developed bourgeois public sphere was based on the fictitious identity of the two roles assumed by the privatized individuals who came together to form a public, the role of property owners and the role of human beings, pure and simple. Tremendous amount that has to be unpacked here. In this notion of the children growing up, that notion of the cultivation of the self, the argument that inside that idea is the idea of a citizenship worth having. If we could all grow up from that position to be citizens at that level, in some sense, of a world in which we were all able to participate. Feeling the resources that we have been given, and so on. That, this idea of you know, when in the French Revolution, the kind of the great universalistic claims, I mean, although marked by gender, so liberty, equality, fraternity, and whatever the non-gendered term of fraternity here would be, belonging, citizenship in a sense, is implicit in this argument here. This idea of, and so isn't it strange that it's in the family, in this bourgeois family, as particular as you like, as narrowly defined as you like, that these great universalistic conceptions also seem to have a place. This is the scope of that Habermas is grappling with. And it's in the public sphere, not in the world of the state. It's in the bourgeois public sphere that these ideas play themselves out. So these people who have been equipped, and you can see why gender comes into it in a profound way here, because, as you know, say, from Mill on the Floss, where Maggie Tulliver is not allowed to go to school, it's boys, if there's limited means, it's boys who are educated. So boys are the ones who are equipped, but of course for the Obamas, that's not a problem. They have the money, they can... So for them, they can, as it were, universalize what was available to bourgeois boys in the 19th century. But this idea that you go in, you feel yourself equipped, loved, you're taught to succeed. You take that, you're also privately successful, privately engaged as a merchant, as a petty capitalist, as someone who sells something, or someone who makes something that somebody wants to buy. And you go, you take those resources, your family background, your knowledge of the market, And you take those and you go into the coffee house. And in the coffee house, somebody is talking something that seems to you just nonsense or something that you want to support strongly, and you say so. Because you're not covered with doubt, as it were. You don't think, I don't have the right to speak here. Everything that's made you who you are tells you that you do have the right to speak here, and that you can speak, and that you can find the right words, and so you do. That's what's being described here. And a couple of points just quickly about areas in which Habermas it's interesting to talk about. One of them we've already discussed, of how constitutive is the absence of women. Is the absence of women accidental here? In other words, are the claims that could be made for the public sphere, which I've been trying to represent, are the claims, could you, in some sense, argue that the exclusion of women from these doesn't alter the content of the claims? That, in other words, in a public sphere that was genuinely inclusive, it would function the same way, or would you have to make different arguments? Also notice that Habermas is has a very rosy picture of the of bourgeois publicness here. We have to look only at Hogarth, for instance, to begin to see how things can go quickly wrong. I mean, this is a very rowdy thing. This man on the right, they're talking about the war. This man on the right is shouting down his opponents. Habermas's phrase is, you want a space where the unforced force of the better argument prevails. Fabulous notion. I love that idea. But can you imagine a world in which the unforced force of the better argument prevails? Brexit, not Brexit. Don't say things like £350 million a day, say, and splash them on buses, etc., when they're not true. Unforced force of the better argument. But here, the unforced force of the better argument can't prevail. This guy's shouting, this one here is in tears, etc., etc. So, or here's another one, coffee morning shenanigans. And we see this is a scene not just of discussion, but of drunkenness, debauchery, whoring, all sorts of things that are going on here, which are quite the opposite of what the bourgeois public sphere was described by Habermas as being. Here's another midnight modern conversation, Habermas says. By the time dawn has arrived, the unforced force of the better argument would never win in this space, etc. Think also of the specific forms. Here's an Istanbul cafe, 19th century, with women or children as very much as servants here. So a discussion of men, you could argue that in this context, presumably, notions of masculine reason, if you like, is constitutive. Is it possible to, as it were, add women and stir to this forum? Then think, just jump forward, here's a workers' tea house, contemporary in China. And again, the same sorts of things are being described here. This is a gathering of workers and drinking tea, usually an hour or an hour and a half or so, long enough to have a conversation, in a public space, and so on. And the same sorts of arguments begin to be made. But here, for 20th century, this would not be the bourgeois public sphere. These are not bourgeois. These people, they are clearly members of the sort of great working class. Is a proletarian public sphere very different in what it aims at? Is there such a thing as a proletarian public sphere? Habermas wants to talk about the link between notions of freedom and bourgeois publicness, but bourgeois publicness is by definition not universal publicness, is it? Lots of things then to think about, but I hope you've got just a sense of what he's trying, what he's getting a foothold into. This stuff, in some ways, you can see why it's been so generative, why people have wanted to talk about this this little book for 62. It's almost 70 years now, so it's been a really important kind of study. So we'll talk more tomorrow. I want to talk specifically about this idea of the performative contradiction of the patriarchal conjugal sphere. So read over those sections. Page 48 particularly. There's one particular long sentence which is almost impossible to pass, which we can start by reading aloud tomorrow and seeing if we can actually make sense of it. Thank you.